Welcome to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Join us for a conversation about faith in everyday life, the trials, the tribulations, and the triumphs. Discussions about how faith matters to you and our community. Support for Faith Matters is brought to you by Hospice of Lubbock, Happy State Bank, and the law offices of Mullen, Horde, and Brown, LLP. Now, here's your host, Ted Dotts.
Hello, I'm Ted Dotts, and welcome to Faith Matters. Today, our guest is Dr. Ted Hartman. I'm delighted to have Dr. Hartman here. He has such an interesting life, and in our conversation together, we're going to get to share that. Now, I'd like to begin by saying, Dr. Hartman, I first knew about you when I sat with a family. You were doing a family member's surgery, and when you came out of the surgery room, came to the family, I was so impressed, and they were too, with your gentle and kind demeanor, and you're answering all the questions they had. Now I discover that you came from the Cajun Plains of Louisiana the first 10 years of your life, and that you have a great affinity for Cajun food. In later years, I knew you as the dean of the medical school at Texas Tech, and then I got to know you when I read your book, Tank Driver, which is about to be published again, and this time in a paperback. So, sir, welcome to you. Would you mind telling us a little bit about how it was like for you as a boy growing up in Louisiana, where I think the Cajun people were about 30% and blacks were about 30, and then you had whites. So what was life like for you growing up there?
It was a very interesting life in many ways, because each of those two, each of the three groups actually, had their own cultures and different interests, and they didn't invade each other's territory with such things as that. It was just typical at that time in Louisiana that a family, a white family, would have a cook, and most of the time it was a black cook who had learned a great deal. The blacks in Louisiana at that time did learn a great deal about cooking from the Cajuns that had moved over into the area, because the Cajuns had such specialty ideas about how you deal with food. And I just thought that was commonplace, that everyone had food like that.
If I understand, you're still addicted to Cajun food.
Yes, I am. It's that way. There's so many little tricks they have to make food delicious.
Now, if you would tell us a bit about you grow up, you move to Iowa, your father's a forester, your mother's a teacher, and then by the time you got to be a teenager, we've got the Second World War looming on us. How did you end up a tank driver in General Patton's Army?
I was a senior in high school, and we were given an examination that was called an A-12 V-12 examination. All the males were, no females. And if we wanted to take it, and if we scored above a certain level, the Army promised that they would send us to university. But first, we must have basic training. So after I learned that I had passed, I went to Des Moines, the main city in Iowa, about 30 miles from where I grew up in Ames, and enlisted in the Army. And I was not to be called for 6 months, they said. 3 weeks after I turned 18, I got my notice to report to the Army. I was taken to the place in Iowa where all of the people going into the Army would be receive injections and instructions about different life in the Army and different clothes. And from there, we were taken by Pullman trains, very old Pullman trains, out to California, to Camp Roberts, California, which is over on the Pacific coast, and had 4 months of basic training in field artillery. And after, when we got toward the end of that, I received a notice that they would be sending me to the University of Oregon for the university program that they had promised. Several of us went from there up to Eugene, Eugene, Oregon. It was a real delight after we had been on those dry plains for all these 4 months to see trees and see green grass and a gorgeous campus. And we had a pretty intense study, 8 to 5 every day and half day on Saturdays, in order for us to be taught all of the things that they intended to teach us. It was called a pre-engineering program at that time. We were there 2.5 months when we received word that they were going to need more ground troops and that they would be closing this Army program that we were in at Oregon, and we would be moved to some place where there were ground troops vacancies that were, so that they would be ready when they started the invasion into Europe a year from then. We all loaded on 2 or 3 trains. A division has 12,000 people. This type of division, armored division, has 12,000 people in it, and they had about 3 different trains to carry us down on special trains from Oregon down to California. We arrived at Cap Cook, California, which was where the 11th Armored Division was stationed. We were interviewed, and I was placed in a tank battalion.
Do you have any idea why they chose to put
I have
tanks?
No idea. I was somewhat mechanical. I could do some things, but they needed people, and that's what the plan was. So I ended up in a tank company. In the tank company, the company commander interviewed each of us new ones and asked what we thought we could do, and there were only certain positions that would be available to us, either a driver or a gunner who shot the big gun out of the top of the tank. And I told him that I thought I could do either job, and so whatever he preferred to have me do, I would be willing to do.
Dr. Hartman, that's grand. I'm amazed you have that openness. I could do either job. We're going into a break. This is Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with Dr. Ted Hartman.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Ted Doss. Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Now again, your host, Ted Doss.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. This is Ted Doss, and our guest today is Dr. Ted Hartman. And Dr. Hartman has just begun to tell us about his life as a tank driver. And he was given the option to be either gunner on a tank or the driver. And with his usual humility, he said whichever one. He could do either one. So, Dr. Hartman, if you would, talk a little more about being a tank driver.
Well, after the company commander decided that I should take a position as a tank driver, we had about 6 months training in how to drive these very old tanks that have been used in all of the Louisiana maneuvers, getting ready back in 1939 and 1940. Gradually, you learn those didn't shift well. They had 5 forward shifts and 2 reverse shifts for speed or moving faster. Gradually, you learn how to do such things as double shift, which I'd never heard of, where you put in the clutch, pull the gear handle down into neutral, then let the clutch out and put the clutch in again, and then shift into the gear you wanted to shift into. Yeah, that synchronized the transmission so that there was no grinding of gears. And that worked out really pretty well, and we had been there about 8 months doing further training, and that was a perfect training place at Kansas. Camp Cook. It was also on the Pacific Ocean, constant wind blowing, as you might expect. Once we were thought to be trained sufficiently, we were told that we would be leaving, but not for where. My company, which had approximately 130 or 40 men in it, boarded with one other company into two trains, which pulled up to the Camp Cook rail station. And we boarded, and each train took a different route from California to where we were going to go. We didn't know where it was to start with. The one train I was on traveled down into Southern California, across Arizona, New Mexico. For some reason, and we skipped Louisiana. We went up into Oklahoma and Arkansas and then back down to Alabama and went on over to Georgia, where we turned north to a camp in New Jersey. And there we were prepared with new clothes, new instruments, new everything, including new tanks. And we stayed there approximately 2 weeks while we were being taught all of the ins and outs of ocean travel. Then on a day which we didn't know, they notified us the evening before that we would be leaving the following day and taking a train over to the New Jersey harbor and then taking a ferry boat across to New York City to Pier 88. At Pier 88, there was this very old British luxury ship waiting for us. And there was a band playing a lot of interesting music, and the Red Cross was there and gave us donuts and coffee. One of the other persons that was there, which surprised us, was our company commander's father-in-law. It was a Postmaster General Walker, and only he, I guess, knew where we were going to sail from all of the people that might have wished to know. But he was there to wish us well on our trip. We boarded this HMS Samaria ship. My company was sent down to a dining room which had tables bolted to the floor and had hammocks swinging over the tables which we were to sleep in at night. We went to bed. We were not allowed on deck the first night. The second morning, we woke up and went on deck, and we were in the middle of the ocean. As far as you could see, there were ships. It was the largest convoy, we learned, that had crossed the Atlantic up to that time. Forecastles of ships as far as you could see in all directions. And that was interesting. We were on deck most of the daytime because it was crowded down in there and hot down in our dining room. One of the persons that really entertained us was the chaplain's assistant. He was from West Virginia in the hills, and he had all kinds of ballads. He had a guitar that he would strum, and we would sing after we learned his ballads. So we had this going on the whole 2 weeks that it took us at that time to cross the Atlantic. We landed in Southampton in the south of England and were taken by train. We were supposed to land in Southampton, but for some reason they changed us, and we were taken to the harbor in Liverpool, England, which is up on the northwestern coast of England. We were boarded trains there and were taken down through this beautiful, lush countryside, seeing all these gardens and flowers off to the sides of the railroad tracks, to the plains of England, which were very flat and very good for tank maneuvering. And we were taken to an army camp, which was a British camp, but which we were to occupy for the time before we were taken across to the continent. We received there our new tanks. And they had come over, we learned, on the same convoy that we had, but in freighter type of ships. And these new tanks, if a tank could be a real joy to see, these new tanks were. They shifted easy. They didn't require double clutching. They had a little better gun than we had on our original tanks back at Camp Cook.
Dr. Hartman, thank you. Listening to Dr. Ted Hartman, author of Tank Driver, soon to be published again, this time in paperback. We will take a quick break and be right back.
You're listening to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1 with your host, Ted Dotz. Welcome back to Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1. Now again, your host, Ted Dotts.
Welcome back to Faith Matters. I'm Ted Dotts, interviewing our guest today, Dr. Ted Hartman. Dr. Hartman was on the consultants panel that helped establish Texas Tech University Medical School, but our interview is covering his time as a 18, 19-year-old tank driver in World War II. We have just gotten across the Atlantic, where he was under constant threat from submarines and the zigzagging of ships, and now we're in England with beautiful flowers and preparation for entering in the battle. And I'm eager to know about how you entered in and how an 18, 19-year-old boy driving a tank into battle. What impression, what did that do to you as a human being?
We were in England for 10 weeks. After we got our tank, we had to spend a lot of time getting them ready because all of the equipment inside the tank had been coated with a type of oily, waxy mixture to keep the sea from rusting all of our guns and various things. And we had to build fires under huge barrels of water every day and put our parts in those barrels. When the material melted, we pull them out, dry them off, and then re-oil them so they were ready for use. And that took us another 2 weeks once the tanks were there. Then we were told one evening that we'd be leaving the following morning, and we would go down in convoy on the highway, on the English highway, down to the coast, where we would board the LSTs, the landing ship tank ships, that would take us to the continent, to France. The ships were very interesting. The LST ship was interesting because it was quite a large ship, and it had a front prow that was shaped like a V, and those V segments would hinge, and they would open out, and then a platform would drop down for us to move off of the ship onto the soil, onto the land. Well, we arrived in Cherbourg, France, and were told that at this point, first time we knew, that the Germans had counterattacked in Belgium and had driven our army back 50 miles, and that we were to go there and participate in retaking that same land that the Germans had just taken from us. We took 5 days to cross France along northern France, stopping at night and sleeping in our sleeping bags out on the ground. And it was December and it was cold. We passed through Paris on Christmas Eve. The people were thronging out in the streets celebrating our coming. Every now and then someone would walk up and give us a bottle of wine or a baguette of bread. We loved French bread. We kept going, though. We got over to where we stopped for the night and readied our tanks for battle. And then on December 29th, we were moved out of that area in France and up into a field in Belgium. We could hear the big guns going at night after we got settled down there. We had our food by then was cans of various pork and beans, Spam, all kinds of different canned stuff. We had a little stove in the tank that we could heat things if we needed to. But that first night, we went to bed out on the snow. The snow was about a foot deep at that point. That it had just been snowing constantly since Hitler had started this reversal and taken those 50 miles back. The snow had continued, and the tanks had no heating in them. There was no air, no way to heat them, and the engine was in the rear on the tank, and it drew the air for the engine through the tank from the front, and that was constant cold air coming through the tank when we were moving. On December 28th, we got got to this place in Belgium, south of Bastogne, which is where the Germans were still trying to take, and the Americans were not letting them have it. We were about 30 miles from Bastogne, where we spent the night. Then the following, we were told that we would enter battle the following day. The following morning, we were up at 4 o'clock, got our tanks warmed up and ready, and we ate some other kind of canned food, cold. Then we started out toward Bastogne on the highway. We left at 6 o'clock, and about 7 o'clock, we turned off that highway into a county-type road. We're moved off then as we passed through two villages, and then further just fields and forests. We entered battle. There were many of the soldiers in our company at that time who were 19 years of age, as was I, that the day that we entered battle. Our first day in battle was very confusing. When you're in action, the seat for the driver and the assistant driver folds down and you sit down underneath the hood of the tank. But you have a periscope that you can look through, and then the tank commander is supposed to give you instructions on what to do. Well, that first day, as far as I could see, it looked like our tanks, everyone was going in a different direction, and I couldn't figure what was going on. But at the end of the day, we had captured our target, our object, and it was the little town of Lavaucelle, Belgium. That had been approximately 6 or 7 miles, and that was the largest gain of the American troops during the Battle of the Bulge up to that time. So I guess our lack of knowledge and confusion probably helped us. But also, very sad, our company commander's tank was hit, and he was instantly killed along with three of the other people from his tank. That night, that day, we lost three tanks and lost a number of soldiers, too, who had injuries or who were killed. It was a shocking sight in a sense, and yet we knew we were going to see things like that. But the first time I saw a dead American soldier that day lying in the snow, frozen, it gave me the thought, my goodness, why do people do this kind of thing? It just doesn't make sense.
Dr. Hartman, when I was a boy, I was younger than 18, couldn't go to World War II, although I sure wanted to, but my uncle brought me back a little Bible that evidently passed out. I guess you received one, and I believe you had one. What did you do with that little pocket Bible?
The pocket Bible just fit into the shirt pocket of my Army uniform. Since I was in the tank and having a light, I could switch on a light by the driver's seat, and every evening I read two or three chapters of the Bible, giving a certain sense of peace and knowing that we would be looked after.
Dr. Ted Hartman has a book, A Tank Driver. It's been out for a number of years in hardback, but he's just received word that a company is going to publish it in paperback. And I have read the book in hardback, and I promise you that if you will read the book, you will discover a huge number of adventures that are deeply moving in the rest of that book. We're only at the very first of it. Dr. Hartman, thank you. What a generous gift you make to all of us who are listening. I just imagine how many people that might be hearing us experience death of loved ones in the military, and to have your sensitivity expressed here is an immense gift to all of us. It's a core to Faith Matters. And I also want to be sure to say you've made a huge contribution to this community. You helped us get the medical school, then you came and served and became dean of the school. Plus, when I think of all the surgeries you did that helped people live better lives than they would have had. Dr. Hartman, thank you for being here. Thanks for going to the work of writing the book. That's a difficult task, too. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Faith Matters with your host, Ted Dotts. Support for Faith Matters is brought to you by Hospice of Lubbock, Happy State Bank, and the law firm of Mullen, Hoard & Brown, LLP. Join us next Sunday for another edition of Faith Matters on KTTZ FM 89.1.